News Talk Breakfast.
In association with AIR. Do anything, anywhere with high-speed 4G mobile data coverage across 96% of the population.
This is News Talk.
Now, people probably too often claim that their guests need no introduction, but in this case, it might actually be right, because this morning we are speaking to the man who is the face and the voice of the Trump presidency. Sean Spicer played a key role in Donald Trump's election and subsequently, of course, became his press secretary. I caught up with Sean late last week and I started by asking him about St. Patrick's Day. Specifically, I wanted to know just how big a deal in Washington is the visit to the White House by our Taoiseach.
It's a big day. I mean, it's huge. And if you think about it, I think that it's gotten lost. It's become such a tradition the last few decades. The Taoiseach's visit to the White House, the events that go around in America. But if you stop, if you're an American and you actually stop for a moment to think about it, you'll realize that no other country gets the attention and the spotlight the way that Ireland does. America truly pauses and recognizes the impact that Irish culture and Irish immigration has had on our country and celebrates it, frankly, in a way that no other country gets that kind of attention.
There are a preponderance as well of Irish names, and there has been around this administration, your own, the Conways, Bannons, Flynn's, Mike Pence, of course, as well, has spoken many
Mick
times.
Mick Mulvaney, the acting chief of staff, John Kelly, the former chief of staff.
Huge amounts of them, yeah. Does that as well, does that mean that Ireland gets maybe more attention than a similar-sized nation might get?
Well, it means that they're never going to be forgotten, I'll tell you that, and it's something to celebrate when you're on the staff. I know it was a special day for me when the Taoiseach came over, and it's like I said, it's a real opportunity to stop, pause, and celebrate the contributions. But I think the point you just made also is needs to be reflected on for a moment, which is when you look around and you're someone like me, and you look around and you say, holy smokes, look at that time, you know, John Kelly, when I was there, was the Secretary of Homeland Security. Mick Mulvaney was the Director of Office Management Budget. Steve Bannon, as you mentioned, Kellyanne Conway, who's got Italian and Irish blood running through her. And you realize all of these senior people share the same ancestry as you. It's a pretty amazing moment to recognize that. And it's that kind of ceremony that we have at the White House and the interviews that people do and bringing that up sort of really brings it to front of mind.
Does that focus and attention translate then to actual policy or any contemporary decisions? Or is it just about, you know, a celebration of culture and a recognition of history?
You know, that's a great question. I think it helps maintain the relationship. As I've said before, someone said, you know, do you think it gives Ireland more attention? I said, sometimes you don't want to get more attention, right? I mean, the allies that you have, the friends that are in your life, you maintain great relationships. Generally speaking, it's the countries that and the issues that are causing concern that bubble up to the top. We maintain a very strong relationship with Ireland, especially when it comes to our economic trade and the relationship that we have and the two-way investment. I think that's a very positive thing. And the relationships that exist up and down, I think, are what helps foster that. And there's a reason that Ireland's not in the spotlight, if you will. And that's because we have a healthy and robust and vibrant relationship with the leaders of Ireland. The Taoiseach's obviously, as the Taoiseach has changed, the relationship has maintained. And that's important because not every country can say that, especially not one the size of Ireland. So I think, you know, when it comes to the relationship, it's healthy and continues to get stronger.
It's interesting you say that, because since Donald Trump assumed the presidency, there's been this real focus here on what's the best way to broach topics with them. You've got one school of thought who says, you know, go in there and be forceful and forthright and bang the table about issues like immigration. And even another school of thought that says, you know, he's not that type of president. He doesn't necessarily like the idea that maybe someone is coming over and lecturing to him. Without actually getting into the issues themselves, you know the man. Which does he prefer? Does he prefer someone to come in and be forceful, or does he like if someone's a little more delicate?
I think it's somewhere in between. I think it's being respectful, and I don't think that it's not one or the other. I think, but in the case of, and it's also important to understand the context of the relationship. We have a healthy and friendly relationship with Ireland. So if a Taoiseach were to come in and to say, you know, I'm going to tell you how it needs to be, I don't know that that would go over well with any president, not just Trump. I think if it was brought up that says, hey, I appreciate our economic relationship. Here are some issues that I think I'd like to address. But considering the direct investment, the foreign direct investment that we share with each other and the culture that we share, especially here in America, you know, the impact that Ireland has, I don't think coming in hot with any U.S. president would be something I would recommend.
Something that undoubtedly will come up, because it comes up every time there's a visit, so every year, is the issue of the undocumented Irish. As you said, Leo Varadkar and others will be keen to keep maybe tax and economics out of the spotlight, but the undocumented Irish will be mentioned. Is it even possible for Donald Trump to consider any type of amnesty for undocumented Irish while immigration and undocumented migration across the southern border is such a hot issue?
No. And I don't think, look, as a, you know, the descendant of Irish immigrants, I don't think America will look at one country in particular and carve it out and say, okay, well, British, you know, immigrants or Irish immigrants or African immigrants or Mexican. Like, I think that it would be wrong for our country to sort of pull out different countries and carve them out when we look at how do we remedy the problem of illegal immigration. So I would argue that carving out one country is not probably a smart policy move.
Brexit will be mentioned as well, I have absolutely no doubt, by the Taoiseach. Does the President have a strong view one way or the other, or is he like a lot of other people, kind of sitting back and waiting to see how this all unfolds?
Well, I think, you know, that's the thing with Brexit that's going to be interesting is I think that more than anything right now, America needs to understand how this is going to impact Ireland. How is it, what is the border going to look like? And if it will, I mean, there is obviously trade issues, immigration issues, transportation issues that Ireland is going to have to address that, you know, and so I think for us, I mean, if you just think about you know, transportation and trade, how they could possibly be impacted, that's something that I think we're probably in listen mode on, trying to understand how this is going to be addressed, what is going to happen, what is not going to happen. So I would hope that the president's in listen mode when the Taoiseach comes to hear specifically, because again, this is much, much bigger now than Ireland, right? Because suddenly, you know, if Britain's out of the EU, then if you land in Northern Ireland and you drive, you know, down to Southern Ireland, how do you regulate what's coming into the country, what trade is flowing, what individuals have come in, and so there's going to be a lot of interest in the US on how that's handled.
I listened to you recently talking about your own political journey, and you talked about when you went to university and you studied Japanese. You wanted to go off and make a lot of money on Wall Street. But you were interesting. You said that after a couple of years, a professor sat you down and said, look, Sean, you know, a D- in Japanese translates as a D- in English, so maybe do something else. If you were grading the current administration, how they've performed thus far, what grade would you give them?
On policy, I don't think that, look, if you look at what and this is where people, you know, if you want to be objective about the president, look at what he campaigned on and said he was going to do, and he's pretty much done it. And so I would give him on policy and follow through an A. I think there's obviously big concern in this country and around the world that is expressed about some of the style. But when you talk about the substance, whether it's tax reform, regulation reform, the stuff that he's done on veterans, and countless other subjects, you may not agree with the policy, but in most cases, you have politicians that run for office promising to do a whole host of things. And then as they come up for re-election, they start explaining why they couldn't get their agenda done or why they had to, in some way, shape, or form, change it. And I think in the case with Trump, he's actually done it. And it's funny because the hit on him is, oh, well, he pulled out of the Iran agreement. He pulled out of the Paris Climate Agreement. Well, those were all things he was very clear about on the campaign trail that he was going to do. So, you know, it's ironic as I watch some of the coverage of Trump here in America that the knock in a lot of cases is he did what he said he was going to do. And in so many cases, it's – they're so used to sort of having the politicians explain why they couldn't do what they said. And so Trump is actually, when you look at the list of campaign promises, what he's actually fulfilled, done, it's very consistent with everything that he laid out in the campaign trail.
Has the presidency been everything you thought it would be, the Trump presidency? Because I think actually it was in the same interview, it was with David Axelrod, who interviewed you after you got the gig, but before it started.
Yes.
And it was interesting. Why I wanted to listen to it is I wanted to get a sense of what you thought it was going to be like. And you mentioned that you expected Donald Trump to unite the country, that when people would see his policies being successful, that it would bring the country along. When you look at where the country is at now, and I mean this with all the greatest respect, was there a bit of naivety in that view?
I think that's fair. I think that's a fair observation. I think part of it, as I've tried to tell people, sometimes I feel like I'm in the business of explaining than you know, it's just saying that if you look traditionally, that's what's happened, right? That people run for office kind of catering a lot to their base and then trying to kind of move to the middle. Trump hasn't done that, and he's not apologizing for it. And I think as somebody who's been in politics as long as I have, I try to explain to people, if you think about it like a sports game, you know, and I apologize because I have to use an American example, but if you think, you know, in football in America, a touchdown is worth 7 and a field goal is worth 3. And I said, imagine if a team at the beginning of a season said, I'm going to try to run the whole season just kicking field goals and not, you know, scoring touchdowns. You would say, no one's ever played the game that way. It can't be done. And I think Trump has fundamentally changed the game in a way that nobody had ever seen before. And so a lot of times I think that your phrase is probably pretty accurate, which is there's a naivete among a lot of folks that said, okay, well, he'll have to go back to traditional norms.
Do you miss it? Because I always got the sense that you enjoyed the gladiatorial nature of it, if we describe it that way.
I don't. I mean that in all seriousness. I think once you step away from it and analyze it, you go, okay, that's not I had been at the RNC for 6 years prior to that, and there's a level of intensity that is, frankly, I just don't think mentally healthy, and probably not physically either, in terms of the hour and the schedule. And there were days, you know, when I look back on some of the briefings, I go, you know, I get it. They were contentious, but I look at myself in some cases, and I'm like, I'm not sure that's who I really want to be. Like, I don't like, you know, yelling at people. I don't like being combative. I like fighting for what I believe in, and I think that that's important, that you want to have principles and beliefs and fight for them. But I also, you know, don't look back and say, gosh, do I want to be the sort of angry, combative, pugnacious guy every day?
Look, you've left the campaign. It hasn't left you maybe entirely, though, because I read in recent days about latest investigation into the president and the presidency and the campaign. 81 different individuals have been identified and asked to provide documents. You're one of them. You said, look, absolutely, you will supply anything that's asked for. You've got nothing to hide. Are you surprised you are on that list? Are you worried about anything?
I'm not worried about anything. No, I would argue
maybe not
that
then in a personal sense. But are you worried about where this is going, this investigation? Maybe not even
I'm
for yourself.
Worried,
for
I'm
presidency.
Worried a little bit. I'm worried a little bit about it in terms of the direction of the country. Meaning, we've had now 3 investigations. If you will, the House of Representatives had an investigation, kind of came up saying nothing. Everyone said, well, that was just, it was controlled by the Republicans, it was partisan, so the Senate's going to be much more bipartisan. Chairman of the Senate Committee, Richard Burr, and Democrat Mark Warner basically have come out and said, okay, well, there was nothing here. And so then now everyone's put their stock in the Mueller Commission, and from all of the tea leaves at least, and obviously we don't know until it comes out, it looks like that while some people clearly interfered with the election, that there was none of this collusion that everyone's telling. This idea now that the House of Representatives is, for lack of a better phrase, going in search of a problem, right? So they're saying, okay, we did 3 investigations. They didn't come up with anything that we thought they were. So we're going to just sort of go on a random fishing expedition and reach out to everybody and every entity, business organization, et cetera, that have been involved and look for improprieties, I think sets us down a very, very dangerous path.
It does. You can see why they're doing it, because some of them will talk about, hold on, Ken Starr was meant to look at a kind of a property development deal, and suddenly he was talking about, you know, affairs during government shutdowns and blue dresses in the Oval Office. And they'll see that that was, to a degree, successful. Bill Clinton wasn't successfully impeached, but it certainly was damaging.
Yeah.
Is that what they're
but
doing
also,
here? Is this kind of Ken Starr 2.0?
One point that's important on that, because I agree with you. You start going down these rabbit holes. But the one small nuance that's important is remember what fundamentally got Clinton. And I know everyone remembers, you know, wants to focus on the affair part of it. But he lied under oath while in office. And that's
a big distinction.
And I only say that because, again, I don't necessarily maybe it's worth a longer discussion about whether it was a good thing or a bad thing or politically or whatever. But the fact of the matter was is that it did address an issue that occurred while he occupied the presidency. The difference here is that it appears as though Democrats are going through everything in the president's personal, you know, business and personal life before he became president in search of something. The Ken Starr thing, I agree, I mean, it kind of got off the rails to some degree, but A, it occurred while he was in office, and B, it went down a hole that existed, as opposed to these folks are basically saying, we're just going to start subpoenaing everything, and then hopefully we find something.
To that point, Democrats often say, yeah, he did lie in office, but he lied to cover up an affair, which is probably what lots of people would do. It's probably a lot of people had sympathy still for Bill Clinton after it. A lot of people, not everyone, but a lot. They could see themselves as lying to cover up an affair. And they say what Donald Trump is accused of is much more serious.
Well, again, there's a difference. Like I said, the president, and again, I think we're splitting hairs here, but the Clinton, yes, and I again, I'm not, it was of a personal nature, but the fact of the matter is he lied under oath in office. And I get your point, but I think the difference is that the Democrats are just going on a fishing expedition. They're making accusations with no proof, and so what they're doing is kind of looking at this thing in reverse, which is let's go in search of something to corroborate our theory and see what we find. So it started off 2 years ago with there's collusion with Russia. We've had three investigations, House, Senate, and Mueller, right? And then so what happened was, at least it appears in the Mueller, in all three, but we don't know in the Mueller case yet, that while people may have broken the law, that there was no collusion, and so now it's like, okay, well, let's go in search of something else. And I think that's a vastly different thing, because it's, at some point, you've got to recognize that we're going down a trail that says every time someone gets elected, let's just kind of go through their entire past and see what we can find.
For the many millions of us around the world who follow Donald Trump on Twitter, it's quite obvious he's agitated, he's annoyed by these investigations. You were in Ireland last year, and I remember you saying he wasn't worried about them, not in the slightest. Is that still the case?
I think so. You know, I obviously you'd have to be inside of his mindset, but I think, you know, it doesn't appear as though that's the case. But I you know, it's difficult to answer that question at this point.
If we're looking forward then, before I let you go, Sean, how does the president win a second term? What's the roadmap to victory?
Yeah, that's a great question. So the way, you know, obviously America's president is elected by electoral votes. He won 306 electoral votes last time. And, you know, as much as everyone wants to talk about national polls and this and that, the bottom line is this entire race will be run in about five states: Wisconsin, Michigan, Iowa, Pennsylvania, North Carolina, maybe Florida, and that's it. I mean, because you've got so many states, so like Texas is definitely in the Republican column, California's in the Democratic column, Massachusetts in the – I mean, you go back and forth, and there are certain states that are basically, you know, not up for grabs, if you will. They might be competitive, if you will, but they're not it's neither party is going to go in and contest them because it just costs too much money. So the battlefield, if you will, is five or six states. And, you know, if you think about some of the president's big accomplishments. For example, he renegotiated NAFTA, which is of help to two main sectors. One, agriculture, specifically Wisconsin dairy farmers, which is going to be huge. And two is the auto provisions that were updated, which is going to be very helpful to the folks in Michigan, another battleground state. So the president has some big accomplishments in the key states that he needs to maintain. But, you know, the election's going to be fought in those five or six states. That's it. So his election strategy is focused, right, laser focused on those states.
Can I ask you one final question then? Is the threat to the president from the Democratic Party most likely to come from the left of the party, the Bernie Sanders and the AOC wing of the party? And if it is that the most... is that the most dangerous competitor for Donald Trump, or would he be more fearful of a centrist Democrat?
I think a centrist would be much more appealing, if you think about it. If you can be a business-focused centrist Democrat, I think you'd have a better chance of appealing to folks in the middle that may have concerns about the president's style. That being said, when you go back to the race, right, and I think that you know, the left, the folks that you just mentioned, the Bernie Sanders, the Kamala Harris, the Elizabeth Warren, those are folks who are catering to the far left, I think have a much higher likelihood of winning the primary. Because in a election, you're obviously catering to your base in either party. So on the Republican, you're going to the right. On the Democrats, you're going to the left. So the more centrist folks in the Democratic Party actually will have a much harder time of getting through. So the irony of it is the people who would, I think, probably make the race is more challenging and more competitive have a harder time of winning the nomination on the Democratic side.
All right, Sean Spicer, thank you very much for speaking to us.